The views and opinions of shows on KCNR are those of the hosts, guests, and callers only, and do not necessarily reflect those of the staff, management, or advertisers of KCNR Radio.
Good afternoon. Welcome to another episode of We the People Radio. You can find us online at wethepeopleradio.us. And you're joined by Aaron Ryan.
And Bill Cundiff.
And Bob Martin.
Nice Hi,
job.
Bob.
Nice job. We
Hi,
all got
Aaron.
Our microphones on.
Yeah, everybody sounds great.
Hi, Aaron. Hi, Bill.
And we have a hostage in the studio with us today. Usually we get to try to call them, and then they're sleeping, and, you know, we have all this
then we have to wake them up. And
the last 2 weeks, phone falderall.
Got them on the head.
No phone falderall today. We've got a live person here. So we have Dave Myers with us, who is the supervisor of the Shasta Trinity National Forest.
Well, thank you for having me on. It'll be great.
See, and for the people who live on the West Coast, they might actually know where that is, Northern California.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the farthest in Northern California, Klamath National Forest borders Oregon. But
and so does the MODOC.
Oh, yeah, true story. How far over do you go?
Well, we border the Klamath is to the north, and the MODOC is to the north and east. The Lassen National Forest touches us on the east side, and the Six Rivers touches us on the west side, and the Mendocino National Forest touches us on the south.
So we're basically surrounded.
We are. We are the largest national forest in California.
Oh.
So there.
Oh, yeah. Well,
that's a fun fact. So for our folks that listen in Philadelphia, what do they have in Pennsylvania?
In Pennsylvania, it's the Allegheny National Forest, kind of central and north. North
and
central.
That's it?
Yes.
And then what about New Jersey? Doesn't have any forest, do they?
No.
I've driven through New Jersey a million times, and it's like, I don't ever see any forest.
No, there's a little factoid is for national forest systems, you know, national forests and grasslands.
Yeah.
There's 155 in the system. There's only like five or six in the United States that do not have a national forest or a grassland.
Really?
Yeah, I think you named one. I think Iowa is one. But, you know, pretty much all the western states, and actually most of the eastern states, because you have all that Appalachia range.
Right.
Yeah, true.
Right.
You know, it's all the way down to Florida, up to New York.
So we're going to try to keep it general. So we have a lot of people, you know, who hasn't been to the National Forest?
Well, if you go to our website, there's a nice little map there that kind of shows the size of the forest area there, and it shows the bordering areas as well, so you can kind of get an idea how big it is.
And with that, you know, it's 2.1 million acres. It's a big area.
Yeah.
It's not the biggest national forest in our system, but it's a big one, and the biggest in California.
As forests go,
Well,
we thought it would be timely to do this, just because we just got done with all the fires. Regardless of where you live, if you didn't live in the area with the fires, you at least had to hear about it all summer long. So we figured this would be a good time to get kind of going on this topic. So you've done this. You've only been here since 2013. You've only been here 2 years?
Yes, 2 years.
Hmm. How long were you in? You were 35 years ago you started this whole thing.
Yeah.
So you're like a career
Forest Service guy. Yeah, green.
Why?
I just love the Forest Service. I love working on national forests. You know, they're a great place to work.
Did your folks or something? How'd you wind up doing it?
You know, I just wanted to work in natural resources. I went to school at Humboldt State, North Coast.
Me too.
There you
go. A couple of alumni here.
Look at that, and we're not even smoking pot.
Go green.
We're not even smoking pot right now.
Yeah.
See, it can happen.
We think we remember going there.
and Bob's wife went there too. That's right.
That's right.
I was there 2 weeks ago. It smells the same.
Go marching lumberjacks.
I was a marching lumberjack.
Oh, so was my wife.
Really?
Okay. Yeah, I don't. We better change the subject.
Yeah.
Ann Palmer, do you remember her?
Was that in the 70s?
I was there in the 70s.
Late
too.
70s, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
That's pretty funny.
I was there in the late 70s, so.
Really?
Yeah.
Like 70 when?
75 to 80.
I was there 79 to 84.
That's about when Ann was there, 79 to 84.
So it's a great natural resources school. I mean, forestry, I was in range management, wildlife, fisheries, hydrology.
There was a ton
going
on.
Some great programs over there.
Oh,
fantastic.
What a setting. School.
Great setting.
Still a
too.
Great school.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was an English major. Makes no sense whatsoever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I get reminded of that regularly. Did I say that correctly?
Yes, you did.
Yeah, okay.
You know, a lot of our leaders in the Forest Service went to Humboldt, so there. That's a good one.
Oh. But, well, really and truly, if you're going to work in that industry, where else are you going to go to school?
Cal Berkeley is one in California, Cal Poly. Mm-hmm. In the other western states, you know, UNR, University of Nevada, Reno, Utah State, University of Idaho, University of Wyoming.
So probably not East Coast, though, huh?
Oregon State. Well, no, there's forestry programs back there, too. You bet.
Mm-hmm. Just different stuff. You're managing different things. Here we have really tall trees. There they have kind of shorter.
Mm-hmm.
Just different issues. They don't have the big fires that we do.
No, the fire frequency is different there.
Is that because of the humidity?
It's just different geographical areas of the United States. So you have different climates
altogether.
So you have just like from Alaska down to here. Alaska is more like rainforest.
Right.
You know, fire return intervals, you know, in the hundreds and hundreds of years. And, you know, in Oak Savannah, where Redding is, it's every, you know, well, five, it's every year now,
every,
but it's
every 5 minutes.
5 years, you wanted a light fire to run under the trees and burn it out.
In the old days, it would just do that by itself?
Sure, yeah.
Plus or minus 5 years?
You know, ours has changed here just because it's all, you know, California's the Golden State, named that way because all the annual grass. It wasn't originally that way. It was perennial grass, so now we have higher fire frequency because it turns to straw when it dries out.
Yeah.
Right.
So that changed the fire intervals, the wildfires.
What about your ability to harvest in the forest and to manage it? If we're gonna suppress the fire, you kind of have to, you can't just let everything just grow and grow and grow.
Well, you know, yeah, that's a big question. So it's the...
That's the fight. That's the big fight in the western states.
Well, and it's come with the change in society, you know. Fire management, the Forest Service was Smokey the Bear, and you know we've been very successful at fighting natural wildfires for well over 100 years.
I like the way you said that, Smokey the Bear.
Yeah, Smokey Bear.
He's not supposed to be Smokey the Bear?
No, it's Smokey Bear.
He's still Smokey the Bear. He's been Smokey the Bear our whole life. That's stupid.
So, but fighting fire, we've been putting out, you know, wildfires. Lightning strikes naturally cause fires, which are generally lightning. For 100 years. So that in and by itself has changed the fire behavior, allowing what would have been smaller, more frequent fires now are larger and more high-intense fires in some of our forested ecosystems. So,
And they're more intense because of the...
Well, there's a lot of factors built into that. There's buildup of fuel accumulations when there's no wildfire. Some of it can be contributed, if you will, to climate change. Certainly with California, the fourth year of drought, that adds a real complicating factor. Usually it's that growth, even natural growth of smaller fir trees growing up in the understory that allow fires to move from the surface or a ground fire to what we call crown fires, where they're running through the tops of the trees under more severe fire weather conditions.
And you just can't get a hold of them?
No, you can't. Not when you have a running crown fire, when the factors align, and the factors being wind and topography and the trees align, and of course humidity, as you mentioned, and temperatures. When they align and it gets in the crowns and is really running, that's a fire that is very dangerous, and you just have to let that run and anchor and get on the flanks of that kind of fire until it sits down. So a lot of different types of fires. So all of our forests don't behave the same with fire. They all have their own different fire regimes and intervals of when wildfire would have naturally occurred.
And how much information do you have to know how to do everything? If you're going to be a forest supervisor, let's go backwards. How does that all lay out? You have guys in Washington, D.C. that are the chief.
We have one chief of the Forest Service, Tom Tidwell,
mm-hmm.
in Washington, D.C. By the way, that's not a political appointee. The chief has always come up through the ranks of the Forest Service. And we're proud of that as an agency.
Oh, yeah, that
who
makes
decides
a whole
that
lot
they're going to be the chief?
Well, it's still through the administration under the Secretary of Agriculture.
Okay.
And so Secretary Vilsack is our Secretary of Agriculture right now.
But they always draw from the Forest Service.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's whether
a great idea.
And so currently, Tom Tidwell started as a range management specialist, working with, like I did, with permitted livestock grazing on national forests in Idaho. And he worked in Nevada. I worked with him in Utah. And he, you know, he was in California as a deputy regional forester. Hmm. He was the regional forester in Missoula, Montana, and then became chief, you know, so really built a career, so he's highly experienced going in to hold that position as chief.
Okay.
So from the chief down, then you go down to the regional foresters, and there's our region is California, and so Randy Moore is our regional forester, and that office is down in Vallejo, or actually out of Mare Island at the very end.
Okay.
Yeah. And so he does all of California?
Mm-hmm.
All the forests in California?
Yeah, and he's my supervisor.
And so do all forests stop at state lines, or
no.
Do some go over?
Some do go over.
Because it's a federal thing. It doesn't have to be
yeah.
state by state, right?
That's correct. And regions go over, you know, depending on how they're Oregon, Washington, or region. California just has so many national forests for a region.
So if you are a regional guy, then you might, do you do a number of forests, not a state necessarily?
That's correct. We just coordinate closely with the states.
Yeah. How many regions are there?
There are 8.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so they definitely aren't limited to a state.
Right.
Shoot.
Yeah.
And then forest supervisor, how far are you away from the regional guy? What do you have
I'm
in between?
I'm directly under the regional forester.
Okay. And you guys are just on one forest. You're the supervisor of that one forest.
Of the Shasta Trinity.
Okay.
So, you know, as an agency, as we call ourselves line officers, the actually deciding officer. It goes from the chief mm-hmm. to the regional forester to myself, a forest supervisor, to a district ranger. So pretty short chain of command, 4 people, and you're down to the district ranger, who is the person, man and woman or women on the ground. And we have 4 districts on the Shasta Trinity.
And is that pretty? Is it just based on the particular forest? How many?
Yes.
How many?
Yeah, just
the size.
Has
divided up.
You know, we're at Mount Shasta. We're in Weaverville, Mountain Gate for Lake Shasta here, and Hay Fork. Those are our main offices, besides my office here in Redding.
Hmm. Well, that makes sense.
All right. Let's take
a
break.
So then we're going to find out what you guys do when we come back. We need to take a quick break here. Are we good, Bob?
Yes, we're good.
I'm trying to read the back of your head.
the light's not on
before
yet.
Before we just, like, stop and there's no sound. You can find us online, wethepeopleradio.us. Everything about the shows, archives, sponsorship, ideas. If you've got ideas for programs and guests, please get a hold of us. We'd love to hear from you.
What shall we do about them?
There you go, our first forest song. We're going to have a litany of forest songs.
A laughing forest.
I thought we were going on the Humboldt State theme there for a second.
Well, you are. It's a laughing forest.
That's where I thought we were.
A lot of laughing over there.
I got confused.
Yeah, a lot of giggling and chortling.
Welcome back. You're listening to We the People Radio. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. We're here with Dave Myers. He is our local forest supervisor here on the Shasta Trinity National Forest. And for those of you who don't live in our area, you should listen anyway because there's probably a forest near you. There's only, what'd you say,
right.
5 states?
You want to know how it works?
5 states that don't have forests?
Right.
Yeah, so see, this is information for everyone.
Yep.
And you had a bunch of stats on fire.
Yeah, we just, you
the
know,
number of fires.
We just went through one heck of a fire season.
One heck. You know,
yeah.
We were doing pretty good catching our lightning-caused and human-caused fires. We had waves of lightning, as you know, came through. First started in June. And
that's what kind of set the whole thing off. To start with, wasn't it, or were there some arson fires?
Well, there weren't arson. They were just man-caused, you know, escape.
People being dopey?
It was so dry with the drought.
Lawnmowers and
just chains dragging, things
yeah.
like that, and just carelessness with matches or whatever. But the lightning, you know, we had a wave of in June, and only one of those fires escaped our initial attack. That's what we call it when we initially attack, either with smoke jumpers, retardant planes. We rappel out of helicopters on ropes, and, of course, our fire engines and our firefighters on the ground, 20-person crews. We caught everything. One got away in June, and it got up to a couple thousand acres. And then
that's
we had another wave, and we caught all those, and another wave, and we caught all those in initial attack. Well, that ended on July 30th when the fourth wave came in with all that lightning that started. When our planes are up in the air looking, when we're getting the lightning, and the reports were coming back over 100 lines of smoke popping out of the woods, that's a bad day.
Yeah,
because
you can't possibly get on top of all those.
We initial attacked, and we just couldn't. So that started, you know, in total we had 229 fires, but after that day started our longer fire siege, which lasted a couple months. Those fires grew together, you know, they all took off the next day with winds that hit them, and they grew and they came together, and we had five large fire complexes. We call them a complex when like three or four fires were kind of in the same proximity.
Mm-hmm.
And they were large. Between our forest and the Six Rivers, which borders us on a ridgeline to the west. So, we threw everything at it, you know, because it was a drought. You know, we weren't doing anything but trying our best to protect people and protect our firefighters. And
you guys don't do houses, though.
We don't do structure protection.
Even if people live kind of near, because I think sometimes, especially people who live in cities, they think if it's the forest, it's miles and miles and miles from where anyone might live. But that's not actually true.
People live
kind of in and among the forest in a lot of places.
That's right. They have there's a lot of private land in holdings within surrounded by national forest system. So in this case, we lost eight homes on private land that was where fires burned off forest and swept through some private land.
Now, when you have structures that are amongst the forest. You don't fight those structure fires. Do you call in like CAL FIRE or do you just get the people out? And
we do our best first to get the people out, and we do coordinate very closely with CAL FIRE. So we'll fight a fire running at homes,
mm-hmm.
but we're just not a structural fire. So
right, your training's not in structural.
Yeah,
right.
You know, we have college kids that work for us. You know, we don't have the equipment nor the training to go inside burning structures. We battle wildfires running at a home, or if it starts in a home and then gets in the woods and goes,
right.
We battle those. So it was a long fire season. The fires burned and burned and burned in a primarily forested ecosystem. It was very droughty. And the challenge there is the fire behavior can be fairly extreme because of the drought we've had. And the large, even the green trees, not just dead, but green trees are, drought-stricken, so
burn very easily.
Very easily, and the fires will spot, meaning they'll throw burning embers a quarter, half mile ahead if they're burning in crown fire conditions.
Mm-hmm.
And the only fortunate thing associated with the fire behavior this year was it was so smoky. The fires had inversions over them, so it kept what I call the lid on the fires. A smoke layer so thick that it prevented the fires from burning with high intensity.
Oh, really? I didn't know that affected the actual intensity of
fire. That's actually helpful?
Oh, yeah.
Oh.
Well, helpful in that it keeps the oxygen and sunlight from
slows it down,
the
but
fire.
It's not helpful
yeah,
in trying to
true.
Fight it because you can't get in there and see it, right?
No, we can get in and fight. You just got to be real careful when the lid comes off because then it's up and away she goes that afternoon.
Right.
So you're always real careful about how extended you are out there on the lines, the fire lines being the where we remove the vegetation next to the fire so mm-hmm. it won't cross those.
Do you guys kind of keep track forest to forest, you know, who's got the most fires in any given year and all that?
We do. The challenge this year when it was not only California on fire and the forests around us,
big.
But Oregon picked
yeah.
up, the state of Washington picked up at the same time, and Idaho. So there was a shortage of firefighting resources between the federal and the state agencies.
We kind of talked about that. I was going to just let people know that on the website, I put a link that I didn't think of until just now, but we did a show with one of your former coworkers, Ray Haupt, on August 16th.
Mm-hmm.
We did a program on fire. Who fights what? What do the federal resources do? What do the state resources do? Why do, what are they situated for and how does it divvy out? So if people are curious about you know, some of the detail of that. We did a two-hour program on it, and the link's right there for you. We also linked a bunch of resources because it's kind of interesting, and nobody really knows. Yeah. You know, the rest of us out here, we don't.
I got a question.
We don't worry
how
about
do
that
you,
stuff.
How do you name these fires?
The first firefighters on the ground usually name them.
Some of them are kind of funny.
Yeah, some things I kind of got to watch to make sure the names are okay.
Yeah.
Appropriate names?
Yeah. You know, but it's usually after some geographical feature.
Right.
There.
I noticed some of them are geographically kind of, symbolic of a
terrain. Yeah, but
terrain
some of the names are kind of funny.
Right.
A creek or something.
Yeah. The Fort Complex was right near Hayfork.
Okay.
You know, the Mad Complex was over by Mad River.
Okay.
So those are okay.
Yeah, we can go with
nothing
those.
Bad there.
No.
So what percentage were caused by people or numbers? You had some numbers.
Yeah, we had, of the 229, 70 were human caused, which is, that's a lot.
That's a lot.
Mm-hmm. You know, especially when, it's well known we're in a drought, extremely flammable out there.
Yeah, over a third of them started by carelessness.
Carelessness.
Not good.
159 of those were lightning caused. And again, we caught all those initial attacks except for 24. But those 24, when they grow, they become large
monsters,
incidents.
Yeah.
And then we bring in management teams to assist and really to do the lead the operations to suppress those fires.
And so, kind of acreage lost.
We were right at 188,000 acres. That's a lot of acres. Mm-hmm. Some of the fires in other states, like up in Washington, grew larger. That acre number can be misleading because, you can have a fire in eastern Washington or in Nevada, and it's burning a lot of grass and sage, and it can sweep through 100,000 acres.
I was going to say, 100,000 doesn't sound like a lot when you look at the size of some of these other fires that burn for months, and they're one fire is over 100,000.
Yeah. Our fires are burning in heavy fuels, not to mention heavy brush, the chaparral brushes, that we have. But those heavy fuels being trees, Douglas fir, ponderosa pine, the white firs that have, up to 3 feet, diameters at the base. They burn and burn and burn. And so all fires don't behave the same. Some are flashier. And some of the lighter fuels are as dangerous or more dangerous to our firefighters, especially in the initial attack, because of the wind.
They go so fast.
Wind changes, and we lost firefighters this year.
Mm.
Here in Northern California, over on the Modoc, with a fire blew up. That was in Ponderosa Pine. We lost firefighters in fire engines up in Washington because of these erratic changes and extreme fire behavior.
Well, you can't fight a fire from the ground once it gets into the crown and starts going through the treetops. That's pretty much an aerial battle at that point, isn't it?
It is. Just even using retardant in front of a running crown fire is something that probably wouldn't be that successful anyway because it spots so far over it. But we do use retardant. We flew more gallons of retardant out of Redding than I think almost any other year ever.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have that number, but it's, millions.
Well, you're using that
gallons.
Big jet now, too, that holds a lot.
Yeah, just the biggest jets. Well, not the biggest, but, 727s were frequently flying out of here. So not
That's
just...
That's pretty big.
Yeah, we were using, just 10 years ago, it was primarily some of the old Korean War vintage retrofitted heavy retardant planes, turboprops. Those planes take a lot of stress when they're dropping loads and releasing and that stress and torque on their wings. So we've had to upgrade the retardant planes. The challenge there is it's extremely expensive, firefighting. Retardant is one of those. The aviation costs are one of our highest line items for fighting fire.
Oh, sure. Those jets are expensive to fly.
Jets, helicopters are really expensive. We have, heavy helicopters drop 300 gallons in a bucket.
Maintenance on helicopters is horrendous.
So, but we used everything we had this year.
People, trucks.
Oh, man.
Some of these places, when you hear these massive numbers of acreage that we wind up losing, it's not always visible for people driving through the forest because a lot of it, I was just looking at some of the numbers, total wilderness area in your particular forest, 498,000 acres.
Mm-hmm.
So if it burned up in there, that you're only going to see that on foot.
Right.
You're not going to drive through there.
Right. So Our fires burned in a lot of roaded areas this year. What we're doing now is looking to improve the safety on those roads because we have standing dead trees. That creates a dangerous situation for the traveling public on our forest roads. Most of those are dirt roads.
Sure.
But, you know, we have a lot. That's what people use when they visit the forest is they travel on dirt roads. Mm-hmm. And so we'll do what we call salvage operations, meaning we salvage the dead trees for lumber. And through competitive bid processes, local lumber mills will bid on those and have a logging operation to remove those.
So in our next segment, that's the $64,000 question.
Yeah, we're going to take a break, but that's something I really want to get into.
Yeah, because everybody wants to know, why can't you just get out there
salvaging more than what we do?
Okay, yeah, we'll talk about that.
Because I know, I can hear people in the back of my head going, yeah, what are they doing about that?
Yeah.
So we're going to talk about that next. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. Joining We the People. You can find us online, wethepeopleradio.us. And we have all tons of archives for, like, I don't know, 5 or 6 years, something like that. And all our shows are fun. We talk about subjects that make you angry, but then we try to goof off a little bit so that you're not actually angry by the time we've done.
You get madder, but at least you're laughing.
At least you sort of had fun while you were doing it. Yeah.
I like this music he's playing.
Yeah, yeah. That's the comic relief that gives us a little break from the, you know.
Is he going to play Smoke on the Water next?
don't ruin
it. I'm sure it's on the list.
Don't ruin his lineup.
There's more.
We take requests.
Okay. We found some good ones over the years. I think the program we did about eggs had, like, the best music, because there were a lot of chicken songs.
Oh.
There were a lot of chicken songs. I had no idea there were that many chicken songs. That was a fun show, too.
Yeah.
Hey, what's the deal with the harvesting of the burned trees? Talk to us about that. People want somebody to get out there and hurry up and use the wood.
Yeah, so whether trees are killed by wildfire or often depending on where you're at in the west, my last forest we had large acres, I mean thousands killed by bark beetles.
Mm-hmm.
That was lodgepole pine. Mm. We're a natural process, by the way. The pine beetles get in there and in drought situations and kill the trees. And so in the Forest Service, we do salvage operations because you're salvaging a dead tree where appropriate for lumber and then try, you know, reduce the fuel and regenerate the forest. So we do that, and we are often and frequently challenged by individuals who are allowed to appeal, object, litigate our projects because it is public land, and so you have the say in how we manage that, and that's what happens. The big challenge is when we get challenged on a lot of our projects associated with timber management, if you will, timber sales.
Yeah, some environmentalist group, I mean, most of our environmentalist groups don't want us to harvest anything. I mean, that's kind of their goal anymore.
You know, the That has changed.
I'll just be the hater.
You can be that. But so that has changed over the years, where some of those groups are actually supporting us for forest management because they see the devastating effects of these large wildfires burning with higher fire intensities than they have in the past. Yet there are still those entities that tend to litigate us. Mm-hmm. And I am...
So you get litigation for harvesting? Because a lot of what I hear is, why aren't we going in and taking more of this burnt wood that is left standing? And you know, you only have a certain amount of time to get that wood out before there's no market value to it. And I think a good example was up at Wairika, the big fire they had up there a year or two ago. Mm-hmm. I mean, over 100,000 acres burned up there, and very little of that was ever harvested. And I know a lot of it was on steep terrain, difficult to get to.
Yeah, but like they put a project together it was 5% of the fire. And that still isn't done.
Yeah, and
that's been a year.
It just seems like an incredible waste of resource, because that wood is marketable up to a point. So what I hear, and my day job, I work a lot with logging.
Bill sells equipment that cuts down trees.
Don't give me up. I'll be getting hate mail. But you know, why don't we have larger timber sales and more of them to because I mean, those trees aren't going to grow back. They're going to be the zombie trees we talk about that are just there and bug ridden, and so
yeah. So it is one of the more challenging types of projects to get through because of what you've mentioned. What you're saying is accurate. There's a lot of our planning that goes into salvaging dead and dying trees. It is litigated, and if we don't get the wood out, so to speak, you know, the harvesting occurring, especially on our forest and in California, within a year, that wood does degenerate.
Yeah,
and it starts a rotting process naturally. It gets blue stains in it.
Mm-hmm.
There's a wood borer that bores holes the size of your thumb in it, and it ruins the wood lumber value. So there's a time frame that we work on, and so I know the fire you mentioned on the Klamath National Forest to the north, the Forest Service does have an aggressive plan putting together a salvage sale. Now, the challenge that I have, too, because I'm doing it now following our fires this year, is that it does still require, even though it's a short time frame that we have, we still have to move through the planning process regulated by law, National Environmental Policy Act. Around this country, Klamath has it, the Shasta Trinity has it, the Six Rivers has it.
Stupid spotted owl.
I was going to say northern spotted owl, but you said...
Yeah, stupid spotted owl.
So
yeah.
A threatened species, right?
Yeah.
Under the Endangered Species Act. Well, it is.
The more we help them, the fewer we have, but let's not let that get in the way.
But it's not a choice as forest supervisor where I...
Right, right. You didn't
I have to
make it up.
Manage the habitat. We certainly manage the habitat for that species. It's threatened, and it's even being considered for endangered. So that even elevates the concern for that species when you have a species where you're trying to salvage the burned timber, yet it's also the habitat right there.
But there's no habitat left in a lot of these areas. I mean, they're just poles.
Yeah, so it's all the short-term impacts versus long-term benefits.
Is it the exact same? How do I want to say that? Okay, if the trees were green, no fire, everything was fine, and you were going to go in and manage that swath of land.
Yeah, because on private...
Versus burned down.
Yeah, on private ground, they have like emergency, I don't know if it's emergency management or whatever it is, but if a fire goes through on private ground, it's a different process to go in and get a harvest plan put together and get that wood out a lot quicker than a regular harvest plan where you would...
do you get a break?
It could take 2 years somehow to get a harvest plan. Is it the same procedures if a fire goes through than if it's greenwood?
For us, it is. Now, of course, we deal with a different set of laws, especially NEPA, the National Rural Policy Act, and our objection process, and we do get litigated more than on state lands, or on private lands, excuse me. But the process is the same even managing green forest, which we have. We do that. We have timber sales, integrated veg, so we reduce fuels at the same time. And we still manage under the same laws, National Environmental Policy Act, you know, meeting compliance with Clean Water Act, you know, endangered species. National Historic Preservation Act, you know, for archaeology. So here it is complicated.
You can hear the clock ticking. Like, oh. just takes forever.
But after a fire goes through, your environment is so much different than the environment you're dealing with when you're cutting green timber. I mean, I can
absolutely
see where...
But the rules are the same.
You have to be concerned about erosion and you know, your footprint and all that. When a fire goes through, you have no control over erosion at that point. That ground is down to the dirt. And I mean, do you still have to be careful not to get mud in the streams and all? I mean, it's going to happen at that point, no matter what you do.
Yeah, certainly we're always concerned about it. And we'll, even after wildfires, we take measures to try to do erosion control. You know, but yes, we still have to follow all the laws. It is urgent, though.
Mm-hmm.
It is the most highest priority I have right now in the Shasta Trinity to do removal of hazard trees along our roads where these fires burn. So
right,
very high priority. Our people are working hard on it. The, you know, our stress levels do go up, that we got to get this done.
And I see a lot of that. I see a lot of the, when these fires go through, you know, you're absolutely right. The first thing you see is the logging companies will go in and they'll start harvesting along the roads to get all the dangerous trees and stuff down. But what about out in the woods? Are those sales processed with, you know, as fast as the ones that are getting rid of the dangerous trees along the roads?
You know, sometimes we'll have less resistance for removing the hazard trees along the roads than the larger units that are off the roads. It just depends on where you're at. It will all vary. It will also vary by where you're at in the United States. Some areas, a lot of areas, of course, don't have the spotted owl. It just happens on the Shasta Trinity. We have one of the last strongholds of that population. That changes the issues.
Yeah.
That elevates it. We also have threatened species of fish, the coho salmon, silver salmon.
The ones we can buy at Costco?
No, you can't.
Yeah,
well,
can.
Yeah, you can. That's mostly a sockeye. But, you know, and we have steelhead in our rivers, where these fires were. So there's those things we can work through, though. It just takes time, and I think we'll be successful in the way we're designing our hazard tree removals this year. We have to be pretty focused, meaning this is what we want to do and get it done, set your priorities, and it has effects on some of our other projects because, you know, you can only do so much with your workforce.
Right. Well, and you have, you know, for the people who don't deal with this very often, the same people sue every forest every time for the most part. I mean, it's pretty repetitive. It isn't
on the
like
same issues, yeah.
I mean, because when most of us think of lawsuits, you think of something someone did to you.
Yeah.
These guys sue just because you've put up a timber sale.
They're suing, alleging violations of the laws I've talked about, the National Environmental Policy Act,
sure,
or the Endangered Species Act. That's what they'll sue the agency on, and we'll have to display how we have correctly met the law and by displaying the facts in our documents. If I have any chinks in the armoring, if a judgment's against us, it turns the whole project away. I just don't fix one paragraph.
Really?
I have to fix the whole thing and start some of that process over.
And a lot of them will try to stop you from reforesting, right? Replanting is now considered bad in some circles.
Oh, maybe in some areas. We do like natural regeneration, but we'll also replant. But, you know, by and large, the concerns are with removal of the trees.
Mm.
And what's your thoughts on replanting? I mean, some folks want it to come back naturally. Some want to replant. I think a classic example is Mount St. Helens, where Weyerhaeuser went in and replanted their property, and now they're already going in and thinning and getting first harvest off of it, where the Forest Service land up there was left to regenerate naturally, and it's just a mess. It's just brush, no trees. I mean, a marketable difference.
Moonscape.
Yeah.
So take a quick break, and we'll come back and talk about.
Yeah.
Let's
right. talk about
Moonscape.
Replanting.
Yeah, because you know, you would think that everybody would be in favor of that, but
sure,
apparently that's fallen out of vogue. It's a frustrating world that you work in. I'm glad it's you, not me. Kind of is me a little bit, but not as
it
much
is
as you.
You.
I just hear all the people complaining. You're listening to We the People Radio. We'll be right back with you. You can find us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
Everybody knows it's you.
Here comes another great song.
Trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
Trees, put them in a tree museum, and they charge the people a dollar and a half just to see them.
That's where you get all your money, isn't it, Dave?
Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They pave paradise, put up a parking lot.
Go, Johnny. You're awesome.
I know it.
Welcome back. So, okay. We have 8 minutes and whatever the thing was you told us. Now I feel all this pressure. What were we going to do? We were going to talk about...
Reforestation, how they kind of hate that now. No, so I haven't heard that anybody hates reforestation. You know, remember, it'll really vary the need for reforesting, which we have a lot of reforest after timber sales.
Sure.
We have to reforest the land.
It's a rule.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we do that. So, but depending on the habitat, the forest type, depends on how the forests naturally regenerate or don't. So if you were to harvest a lodgepole, you would generally like to, basically clear cut because it regenerates in full sunlight.
Mm-hmm.
And generally happens after fire or even after, mechanical harvesting by natural seed source.
Well, also, isn't lodgepole kind of a higher elevation species as well? I mean, they're like 5,000 feet and up.
Right. And so ponderosa pine, too, you know, likes full sunlight, and you can replant that, and we do that. We have plantations on the forest that we'll manage. In fact, we're going in and thinning some of those for commercial firewood now. Lumber.
So when you old enough, when you replant, when so say fire goes through and you replant, do you replant all the species that were there before, or do they typically go in and just, because that's one of the complaints I've heard. I got an argument with a guy one day. He said, they go in and replant all they put in his lodge or ponderosa pine, and it just looks terrible. And what's the actual procedure there? I mean, do they mix it up?
Well, across the, you know, like.
Probably tons of rules, right?
Well, we have silviculturists who their profession is managing forests, and so the rules they follow are let's re-establish that forest based on the habitat type. So we'll plant ponderosa where ponderosa is the habitat type. If it's mixed conifer, meaning Douglas fir and other fir species, we'll plant those trees. But we don't generally replant all the acres of a wildfire.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of it does come back naturally, and this year the wildfires didn't kill all the trees. You got to realize that too. Just because we have 190,000 acres burned, all the trees aren't dead.
It stays on the ground and goes through quick. It doesn't kill them.
Yeah. So we have different fire intensities and different amounts of fire killed trees. Our first priority will be to remove the hazard trees along the road, and that's not directly adjacent. That, you know, we'll need to go out 150 feet on each side at least, so that trees aren't going to be able to reach the road when they fall over.
Sure.
And we got to do that quick, again, so we have value. We do support communities in the mills. We have a lot of mills still in Northern California, and it's good to get those trees to the mill. As opposed to other places in the United States, we've lost what we call the infrastructure, the mill capacity. Or there aren't any mills left. They went out of business. So
yeah, what's this? You had 21, 22 mills at one point, now they have one?
One or two, yeah.
Yeah, so
it's a huge difference.
You know, like many industries in the United States, there used to be a lot of real small mills, mom and pop mills. Now it's, you know, obviously they're much larger industrial strength mills that are run economically. They do different species. They cut different types of wood, make different products.
Sure, because all mills don't do all types of trees.
Well, no, there's mill. Most of your mills now cut small logs or small diameter logs. There's a few that do big logs, but again, depending on where those sales are, it may not be economically feasible to cut
them all
big trees and haul them 500 miles to a big log mill. So
Yeah. So, you know, following wildfire, we do a lot of ecological restoration. It's just not planting the trees in some areas or managing for the natural regeneration. We'll do erosion control. We'll put, in some cases, we're replacing small culverts that were undersized to larger ones to allow for fish passage that before fish were stopped at that culvert. So we do a lot of different things. We do a lot of weed control because we're concerned about noxious weeds coming in after fires. You know, it's expensive work, though. And we this year we're challenged because we have, you know, so many acres to deal with.
And out when you're out in, like, the wilderness, the things that are actually classified as wilderness, totally different rules there?
Well, no, a little bit in that...
I know you can't fight fire with anything mechanized.
Well, we can.
So you have to just run out there with, like, shovels and...
No, yes and no. I mean, okay, let me
be clear. It's kind of bad, though, isn't it?
So, dynamite. I saw Big Valley. You take nitroglycerin on a wagon, don't you?
It was in a hearse, if you're talking about that particular Big Valley episode.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Okay, you guys. Hey, the wilderness areas, okay, they're designated by Congress, right? So they're non-mechanized.
Right. Stupid Congress.
But I do have the authority, and through the regional forester, again, my boss, remember, to use mechanized use where appropriate. So this year, with the drought conditions and the fires moving the way they were, I would authorize chainsaws in some places. In some places, I authorized pumps to pump water out of the streams to put in the hoses to fight the fire. We use aerial attack, being helicopters and retardant. But, you know, we prioritize that where there's structures at risk as a priority. So that's not going to be in the wilderness.
Sure.
But we still...
When it's burning towards someone's town,
yeah.
You know.
So if it's something's in the wilderness and it's going to come off the forest into private land and threaten structures, I'll use it there. So we do have the capability there. It's just not all or nothing, but we do have to have the appropriate, I like to use the words, appropriate management response in places. Because, again, it's so expensive. We can't throw everything everywhere in terms of our fire suppression equipment. We just don't have enough to go around.
Okay.
And then what does that do to your, okay, is fire is a separate budget, right? Does that come out of your budget?
Well, we do have a budget for fire suppression, yes. And the big issue in the Forest Service and actually fighting wildfires on federal ground and even on state land, but I'll speak to the federal budget in the Forest Service, is that over half our budget right now is taking up with the cost of fire suppression because it is just escalating. And it has been over the last 10 and 20 years. So now, you know, we're a multiple-use agency. You know, we've been talking a lot about fire and timber.
Yeah,
but
I was going to say we have all the politics in the forest to do the second
hour. We also provide the most outdoor recreation opportunities in the United States.
Oh, yeah, we'll talk about that.
On national forests. And
sure.
So a lot of programs, fish, wildlife, recreation, wilderness. So we can talk about that stuff.
Sure, sure.
Yeah, because there's a ton of other stuff you guys do. And I'm curious about the budget, too, just because it's a huge line item and taxpayers should know how
That's
that
right.
works. And most of us, it's a big mystery.
Yeah.
All righty. We're going to come back a second hour with Dave Meyer. He is our forest supervisor here on the Shasta Trinity National Forest. You can find all sorts of good stuff about Dave and our local area here. WeThePeopleRadio.us. Be right back.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Good afternoon. You are rejoining We the People Radio. Doing a two-hour deal on the forest today.
Yeah, all right.
Smartening everybody up on the forest. So we're here with Dave Myers. He is the supervisor of the Shasta Trinity National Forest. And how many people work in your forest? Like 400 and whatever, it's 470 or something?
Yeah. In the summertime, we have a lot more when all of our firefighters and college kids come to work for us, work in recreation and wildlife and fisheries.
So, tons of stuff.
Yeah. We'll have 700 people there.
So first half, we sort of chatted about, you know, fire and that kind of stuff. But here on the break, you guys were talking about thinning, some of the thinning. Okay, so explain how that works, because there are people who still believe that cutting any trees, that, you know, we shouldn't be cutting any trees.
Right. So, you know, part of our mission is to manage for healthy forests, of course. And all lands are... we have a diversity of types of lands on the National Forest, and some of those we definitely identify for forest management. Those that are forested and have different attributes that they're eroded, and we've managed those, meaning that we've had silviculturists identify timber sales where we've logged and then we've replanted or they've naturally regenerated. And that might have been 40, 50 years ago, sometimes shorter, sometimes longer, depending on the forest. And it's time to thin the forest. So we would thin to maintain the health of that stand of trees. With pine, it's generally sooner because they grow quick. We were talking about ponderosa pine. So you need to thin those trees so the remaining trees can grow healthier. If you do that, we do that on the forest, and it is fairly costly, usually done with a chainsaw, manual labor if it's pre-commercial. Pre-commercial being the trees you're cutting down are not big enough to be sending to the lumber mill because they just are smaller diameters, 4 inches.
And so they cut those down and either leave them lay or they chip them and leave the chips laying on the forest floor to just biomass back in?
Right.
Okay.
And that's a good practice. It contributes back to the soil. If we chip them, generally chipping's, for your audience, is a piece of machinery that chips them up and we could send that to a biomass plant. If those are available, many times they're not available because that's costly to put those on trucks. But we do a lot of that on the Shasta Trinity.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes we thin the forest where it's commercial thinning, where the trees are large enough, like larger than 8-inch diameter.
And you would sell that chunk of work to a company that is a logging company.
So you put a sale up, you mark the trees that you want to cut, they go in and bid on it, and...
And you're left with a thin stand that usually looks pretty nice, and it allows more sunlight, less competition for the remaining trees, and they grow larger and much more vigorous.
And it provides habitat for, grass will grow, and I can get more deer, mm-hmm. more ground.
Well, less animals. Likely to go up in a giant catastrophic fireball.
That's right.
Right.
And, they're more resistant to insect and disease. The insects, again, are natural occurring, but they increase in population during droughts
mm-hmm.
where trees are already stressed.
Stressed out, yeah.
So there's a lot of, and that's what we do in the Forest Service, a lot of it. But we also like to be well-known for multiple-use management. We have a lot of other uses, hunting and fishing.
Yeah, let's talk about the recreation.
Yeah, because let's see, on this forest here, I got your stats right here.
Yeah,
right. 1,500 miles of trails.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's a lot of trails. 1,000 roads for passenger cars, 3,600 miles of roads for high clearance vehicles. What is that, like four wheel drive type stuff?
Yeah, just your typical four wheel drive SUV, pickup, Jeep.
So is that 4,600 miles altogether, or is mm-hmm. it 1,000 of the 30? It's two totally separate things. That's a lot of road.
We're a fairly heavily roaded forest. Some of it because of our past timber management practices, the timber sales provided for the road systems to be put in. Mm-hmm. And that happened, from the 50s and 60s and 70s on.
Because the loggers did that.
Yeah. It was associated with, and that allowed for improved access to the public to our national forest.
And firefighting.
Not on all the areas. You mentioned earlier our wilderness areas, of course, are not roaded. So we do not allow mechanized travel in there, but we do, of course, allow hiking. You can ride your horse in there, so it's a different experience. And that's what we try to balance, is the different experiences for the public to access and use the national forest. And we have a good mix of that on this forest.
When it says 145 developed recreation sites, because mm-hmm. you have 76 campgrounds.
Yeah, which is a lot of campgrounds.
That's a lot of campgrounds, yeah. And group campgrounds, 10, picnic areas, 16, you have 12 boat lodges? I guess I didn't know there were that many. But what's 145 developed recreation sites? What does that mean?
Well, those are primarily campgrounds, and then there'd be trailheads. Some of them are just picnic areas, rest stops like along the Trinity River where you pull out and for fishermen access, a lot of things like that.
Oh, like up there at Hat Creek, you pull off, you got a nice little picnic area along the mm-hmm. creek, you got fishing access.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay.
So, and that's our recreation program. It's expensive to maintain.
Because that doesn't cost anybody anything. The campgrounds do, but you can stop at the picnic areas, and that's not a charge typically, is it?
Typically not. Generally, when we charge, it's because we're providing some service with restrooms or water back to the public. And a lot of times, too, our fees are allowed to return to that site to maintain the site.
Oh, that's a good idea.
Yeah, and it's hard. You can imagine how hard it is just to maintain your house. Maintain things in the mountains.
Oh.
Especially if there's snow and rain.
Well,
and
you got animals
all
eating
those
stuff.
Well, not,
bugs
not everybody's real nice to the, you know,
yeah,
the site. You know?
There is unfortunate vandalism to a lot of our sites.
Well, snow's really hard on structures, too.
Snow is hard on everything.
Yeah.
So back in the, like, since you've been doing this, like, 35 years, not the same job, but, okay, so 35 years ago, probably a giant percentage of your budget was from harvesting trees. I would imagine way more than now.
It was, we had a much larger timber program back in the 60s and 70s, and, you know, from the late 80s through the 90s till now, it has declined.
Kind of neck down.
We are trying to have a upward trend in managing our vegetation. Vegetation includes timber management, fuels management, again, to address some of these larger high-intensity wildfires that we're experiencing. And, you know, that's not just anecdotal. We have data on that, you know, especially if you remember the Yellowstone fires of 1988.
Mm-hmm.
Remember that? Yeah. Pretty catastrophic.
Oh, those were just massive, yeah.
And that was, it was lodgepole. It was at high elevation. But it moved across there. Since that time, if you look at our data, we've had larger wildfires. Our fire seasons are longer, and the fires are burning with higher intensity. And you can point to a lot of reasons, but those are facts.
And what, do you think are the major contributors to that? Is it just the drought? I mean, is that the major? I mean, we've only been in this drought for what now, five, 6 years?
Well, droughts don't happen overnight. I mean, they kind of creep up on you. So
I think it's a combination. I believe there's a climate change factor in there over that length of time. We've seen some of that. Certainly drought by regions. So from there, it's hard to say, but you know. We're fighting fire darn near year-round in California.
Right.
And
you know, one thing that people it used to be not – I'm assuming it's still the same. When the Forest Service puts a sale up, doesn't a portion of those proceeds go back to the local school districts? Is that
– Yeah, there's what we call the 25% fund. 25% of the receipts would go back to the counties through the states to support schools and roads.
Mm-hmm.
You bet.
So counties
like
Trinity,
that.
What percentage of their county – It's a huge percent.
I believe it's 72%
national
forest system. And so that's a large percentage that I manage of that county. I don't manage the county, but...
So there's no property tax. Bottom line, 70% of the county ground is not eligible to generate property tax. So when you start looking at supporting police, fire, schools, roads, all that stuff...
It just makes it that much more important that we manage the forests and
make it and if we can,
kick
you know,
some of that funding
timber.
Back to the local folks.
Yeah.
Okay, so as that has diminished, then we have payment in lieu of taxes. We have a PILT line item budget in the congressional series.
And there's secure rural schools.
And there's that, yep.
Which is another.
But now that's being kind of considered as like a rural welfare, if you will.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really looked down on, and what I think is not realized is that used to be, it's like, hey, we're going to take your ground, we're going to make it part of the National Forest System, but when we harvest the timber. We're going to kick part of it back, and that way you guys don't, you know, actually wind up.
And that's a good program.
It's a great idea, but if we don't get the harvest,
then it hurts.
It changes the entire dynamic.
Yep.
Okay, so more of that in 5 seconds after we chat with our advertisers and find out what snazzy music Bob has for us. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
And sing and you cuss and fight on Saturday night. You go to Eugene, and on a Sunday morning, your pockets are clean.
Will you tell me something, Mr. Lumberjack? Is it one for forward and three for back? Is it two for stop or four for go? Boy, ask a whistle punk. I don't know.
Well, there you go.
Oh, yeah, forget to bust into the Lumberjack songs. There's plenty.
Yeah. Most people don't know what a whistle punk is. Yeah.
Do tell.
Yes. He's the guy when they run the big, when they're hauling the logs up out of the valley on the big cable, he's sending that thing up and down the line to haul the logs out. Yeah, you got to pay attention out there. You got a log on the side of your cranium. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right.
So, okay, so we were talking about recreation on the forest.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you're talking about recreation, then we've got to talk about all the recreation.
Yeah.
And part of the recreation, unfortunately, out here in the West includes marijuana.
Yeah. One of my favorites.
Da, 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 da.
Yeah.
And a lot of that is unfortunately grown in our national forest.
National forest.
Yeah.
Illegally, I might add.
Yeah, I was going to say. Yeah. Not on purpose.
Just no good upside to any of it. You know, we're referred to as the Golden Triangle between the Shasta Trinity, the Mendocino, the Six Rivers. And it's much worse than the old days of the 60s or 70s when you referred to hippies growing a little bit of marijuana or Humboldt home grown. Garberville was the worst it got.
It's way beyond that. This is commercial.
It's like on the national forest of what I'm concerned about with the illegal grows, grown by non-citizens of the United States.
A.K.A. Mexican cartels.
Cartels, primarily.
And some Hmong. Are they cartels too?
I don't know if they're cartels, but they're criminal organizations. Yeah.
Definitely criminal, definitely illegal. The concerns I have are the threat to our publics who unknowingly stumble upon these.
Yeah.
Sure.
To our own employees who have come across the illegal grows and the armed growers.
Mm-hmm.
And then also, and not to be underestimated, is the negative natural resource effects from all of the pesticides, which include insecticides and rodenticides. Rodenticides, those to kill rodents that would otherwise eat the marijuana plants, and the unauthorized use of millions of gallons of water and fertilizers.
Water was a huge issue this year.
Oh, yeah, but if you look at the pictures, I don't know if you've ever seen the pictures of some of these grows they've busted and the trash that's laying around. I mean, it's just a total mess. But look at what that trash is. It's empty insecticide cans. It's bottles. They use some heavy-duty chemicals
out there. Be the stat man for us, Dave.
I've got to be the stat guy. We just cleaned up on the National Forest just 7 sites last week.
This is just the Shasta Trinity National Forest. Okay.
And cooperative effort. Mm-hmm. And it does take cooperation because we don't get any one-line item to do this. And it's a scourge on the national forest, in this area particularly. On these 7 sites, nearly 25,000 pounds of garbage.
Whoa!
Okay, they illegally used, daily estimate of the water, 292,000 gallons. And, of course, we're having a drought. Yeah.
Holy mackerel. Per day?
Yeah. 8,000 pounds of fertilizer.
Yeah, and no telling what that is.
51 pounds of the rodenticide. Now, that rodenticide is not EPA approved. It's illegally coming in from Mexico. Extremely lethal to animals.
Is that the commercial name of it, rodenticide?
Well, no, that's a common name.
It's what
it is.
Rodent.
That's what it is.
It's
rat poison.
Yeah.
But it's stuff we're not allowed to use here.
So if it kills rodents, what else does it kill?
Well, it's killing bears.
Mm-hmm.
It's known to be killing fisher, which is a little fur bear. About the size of a bread box, if you know what a bread box is these days.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah. Good thing we're all old.
Yeah. And the fisher is a unique little species, lives in the forest, so it's dying.
Well, don't they eat mice, or what do they eat?
Well, they'll eat mice, yeah.
The fisher?
Squirrels, yeah.
Yeah.
And so when they're getting this contamination from eating a dead rodent, they too are dying, and they're a threatened species, or proposed to be threatened. Because their population is already at risk. And so there's all these different negative cumulative effects from the illegal marijuana grows.
And all that stuff goes into the water table.
Down to the water.
It all gets in the food chain, because if you hunt at all, good luck. What's going on with the deer population?
Well, it's there is just research going on now by private individuals, and they've made presentations to us, and they're showing bioaccumulation of these insectus or the rodenticides in the livers of deer and in quail. So these are game animals, obviously.
Sure, we're going to be eating those.
And so it's of great concern. And then, of course, this the pollution into the water. Our Forest Service crews, after the wildfires, looking at streams and the effects of the wildfires on the streams, found that the streams below some of the known marijuana grows had salt accumulations, salts being deposited from the runoff from the over-fertilization mm-hmm. of marijuana grows. So it's one thing after another.
What about the direct contact of those products on, you know, firefighters, law enforcement, you know, when they go into one of those grows?
We're just learning more and more about that, but it's so I can't tell you exactly what it causes, but our law enforcement officers have had a lot of different exposures, you know, from contacting the illegal growers or just the plants as they chop them down when we do go and raid the sites, or all the unauthorized irrigation pipeline that they put in, cleaning that up, are exposed to all this. And so it's...
And again, these are products that aren't even legally used in the state. They
right.
bring this stuff in
because
you're not, it's so effective, but it's not legal, and that's why it's not legal.
Exactly.
And you're not talking about a little small backyard garden. I mean, this is... What kind of acreage are you looking at for some of these grows?
Well, you know, they could be 5 or 10 acres or 20. They're spread out, though. They're different than the grows on the private land. Private land, if you fly and look at those, it might look like a... They look like
corn.
Grape.
I mean, just
yeah,
rowed up.
Rows it like, yeah. You know, might be an acre or two, but on the national forest, they're 10 and 20 acres, but they might be 70,000 plants this year. I mean, huge numbers of plants. And the plants are growing big. They're not the little scraggly plant you used to see on a T-shirt from the 70s. You know, they're big, if you will.
Back to college again.
Yeah, changed since I was a
yeah,
kid.
A big, thick Christmas tree. That's yeah. how big these
really?
Marijuana plants. Oh, yeah. So picture that, you know, 70,000 plants like that. So this area of the Northern California, between the federal lands and stuff grown on the private land, produces a lot of the marijuana in the United States, and it's a huge impact on your national forests. And we're working on it, but it's a big problem.
Mm. So I'm kind of always, you know, I can always hear the taxpayer's wallet in the back of my mind.
Mm-hmm.
That's a huge cost to taxpayers.
Yeah.
It's
a huge cost.
That's not a benefit to them using the forest. There are all sorts of things you're not able to do for people who would like to come and recreate.
Yes.
So you can't do that. And so where's the environmental community on that?
They're very opposed to it, too. It's just we are having to work cooperatively with multiple interests to attack this problem. We have to come together stronger as communities to attack this problem because people that are not United States citizens are taking away some of our national forest resources and are a threat to our publics and to us.
Well, they have.
And they're always armed. So it isn't like if someone's out there hiking and,
yeah.
you know, stumbles across one of these things, they're all just having sandwiches together.
It's not just Barney Five going in with his six-shooter to bust them. It's
yeah.
a full SWAT team-like event when
sure.
you go in because they are multiple people and they're armed and they're desperate type of people.
Yeah. And you're talking about a lot of money. I mean, they're put in charge of an operation and they're going to defend it. I mean, it's... Well, they just prosecuted a guy the other day.
I would imagine if you don't come back with your allotment, there's consequences
for
that.
Oh, I'm sure there is. They just prosecuted or sentenced a guy the other day, I heard, that actually had some folks working for him that were illegals that he was basically, they were basically like slaves, and he treated them that way. And when they busted the operation, they kind of ratted on the guy, and I think he got, I don't know, 50 years or something. It was a bad guy, and that's who's out there in our forest. So yeah, stumble onto his grow. I'm sure he'd just show you the way out.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so that's why when people say, you know, well, we ought to legalize all this, you know, it's a victimless crime. Well, here's your victimless crime, and
yeah.
there's money to be made, so that's not going away.
No, it's unfortunately this is a good area to grow that marijuana. You know, it's been an increasing problem on the national forests, many national forests in the West. it's just, again, unfortunate. This area is like a golden triangle because of the conditions for growing. Or you know, because you do need water. And,
right.
And see, they dam up the streams and put that black irrigation pipe in and then spread that water out across a hillside. And it's remote. It's just not like you can see these. You stumble upon them.
Right.
But they're in backwoods. They're hard to get to. And quite a problem. But we're really trying to work on it. But it's probably one of our biggest challenges. And ever increasing, we're getting more information on the toxicity of these sites. We're referring to them as hazardous material sites.
And what's that doing? What's that doing to your budget? I mean, is it starting to consume more and more?
Well, we don't have a direct budget for it. You know, it's just that kind of thing that's happening on the forest that we have to take little pieces of all of our budget to go work on it.
It just takes resources.
Right.
Yeah.
And what was the give the water number again?
Let's see. Well, it was estimated water usage over that 150-day growing season was close to 4 million gallons. Jeez. And that was over these seven sites, 292,000 gallons a day. So they use a lot of water.
And now, see, here you have people, you know, this, you know, this is kind of like a little problem for me.
Yeah.
You know, in California, everybody's supposed to let their yards die and take showers for 5 seconds and all this stupid stuff. When half of our water goes to fish and 3% of the water is what we're going to cut ultimately. 10% is used by people. So if we save 30% of the water used by, you know, towns and stuff like that, it's 3% of California's water. I don't know what the total water usage is in the state, but I got to tell you that probably we could have let our yards grow.
Well, you know, and what I relate it to is the wildlife and the fish.
Oh, yeah.
Because they're directly killing the wildlife.
Anybody else did that, they'd be hung out.
They're polluting the water where we already have a threatened salmon and steelhead, directly.
Mm-hmm.
We're not estimating it. We know that.
Sure. And but so, we're constantly ringing out the ranchers and farmers because, you know, you had a goldfish died in their irrigation ditch. Oh, my God, it's a crisis. And here you got these guys. Who knows how many?
Yeah.
How many they're killing?
Yeah, that's just what we know about. I mean, imagine what's out there. Obviously, a lot more that's not getting caught, or they wouldn't be doing it.
Yeah, and what's the half-life on these chemicals? I mean, it isn't just 1 year.
Yeah, you know, since EPA doesn't approve it, I don't have the sheet on it, but it's I don't know how persistent they are in the soil, but the concern is they're transmitted, you know, bioaccumulating in deer.
Mm-hmm.
That's not good.
No.
Yeah, it's not good.
You know, it's killing indirectly the fisher, which eats the mouse, which ate it,
mm-hmm.
and directly killing bears.
If it's killing a bear,
it's no good.
Yeah, it's probably not going to be
and
good.
And our own law enforcement officers, you know, they're seeing these side effects. And
yeah, they go home and take that home to their families.
Starts accumulating. And so we're concerned about our firefighters. You're digging line and you bust into one of these and, you know, are you getting it on you?
Exactly.
And how do you know?
Yeah.
You're in the middle of a fire.
Yeah,
or
unfortunately,
you're
you don't know until you come down with a symptom.
There's a lot of fire or a lot of hunters around here that give me the stories too. They've been hunting because where do you hunt?
Sure.
Where there's no roads in the backcountry, and they're sneaking into them, and then all of a sudden they're looking around. And there's marijuana plants.
It's like, uh-oh, yeah, well, here they are.
Yeah.
All right, we'll come back with more interesting details.
Of our national forest.
Yeah, you know, there's all sorts of stuff.
Very diverse.
It's like we have two hours worth of material, don't we? Yeah, of course we do. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. Just tuned in. You have to listen to the segment before.
Wow.
Like, why are they playing this? You are listening to We the People. You can find all our stuff online, wethepeopleradio.us. We've got years of archives and fun music for you. Good topics, too. Lots of interesting stuff you don't hear much about anyplace else. We're here with Dave Myers from our local forest, the Shasta Trinity National Forest. He's our forest supervisor. So we're talking about all the stuff that affects, I guess, the forest. And on the break, we were talking about wolves. We've done lots of shows on wolves.
Oh, have you?
Lots of shows on wolves,
actually.
You
don't hardly have any wolves here. And you're doing shows on it?
Oh, yeah. We've done bunches of shows.
We preempted. We knew they were coming.
We was way ahead.
Well, you're way ahead of your time, but you're right up to speed now because we have some.
Yes, we do. It's like a miracle.
Yeah, people are thrilled.
How did we know?
Well, you know, the idea was if we educated people, maybe they'd be a little less, starry-eyed. Oh, isn't this wonderful? We're going to have wolves. They're so furry and friendly. Yeah, they're not furry and friendly. They're killing machines.
Well, they're predators.
I said it first.
They're part of the natural ecosystem.
Yes, they are.
There's probably a couple different opinions on this species, wolves.
Of course there are.
They're excited probably about seeing wolves in that wolf
there was
pack.
There was a lady. I sat in the hearing over there when they listed them over in Fortuna. This woman got up and said that she just implored them, you have to list them as an endangered species because I want my three-year-old to have the ability to meet one in our backyard.
Oh.
And it's like,
oh, really?
Are you kidding me? Where's Child Protective Services when
That'll
you need
a
them?
A short meeting.
How stupid was you know, that's what people think. They think it's just going to be
this. They think they're just like a friendly.
This terrific little thing. So now that they've been listed in California, and obviously we're going to get some more.
And now we have some.
You've seen them. Being in Montana and other places.
Yeah, in Wyoming we had wolves in Idaho. And
How'd that work out?
Well, you know, it was interesting to watch a species that was reintroduced to Yellowstone. And I think Secretary of Interior Babbitt, under the Clinton administration, released wolves, the gray wolf we're talking about, in 1995. I think it was 95, might have been 94. And also there was a release at the same time in the Frank Church Wilderness in Idaho, which is a very extensive wilderness area and backcountry area. And watch those wolves, you know, get, conditioned to Yellowstone where there was strong, and we were talking about this, very strong elk populations, buffalo and moose, and nobody told the wolves to stay in Yellowstone. And so they emerged out onto the national forests around there and of course on the private lands and the same in Idaho. And so since then those populations grew and each state then managed those populations as experimental. Well, the experiment seemed to work because the ones I am aware of in Idaho, they moved across national forests such as the Payette Forest and the Boise, where they're, you know, establishing various packs as they do because that's what they naturally will do. And the forest would, of course, manage our multiple-use programs. We manage and allow livestock grazing on the forest. So that was my familiarity with it. We had permitted sheep and permitted cattle, which would, you know, wolves would then be a predator.
Sure.
So there was that issue, undoubtedly. And I'm sure there's concerns with that today, you know, with where wolves expand to, because then they, when they left Idaho, they crossed the Snake River. I don't know if they swam or walked across the dams.
Oh, they paid their ferry due, and they got on their little boat.
Now, wolves, they're incredibly adaptable. They're incredibly smart. So I think my money is they walked across the dam. And anyway,
they could very well have,
Well, people are under this delusion that they live out in the wild, and we're never going to see them. Well, if it's a lot easier to just snack on everything that's in a, you know, that's held up close, why wouldn't you do that?
Well,
they're smart.
You know, and they did. There was predator control programs where they would start to eat the cattle, you know, whether it was cattle or sheep. Sheep were more like a Shangri-La sort of environment.
Yeah.
If you get a band of sheep, because a band of sheep on a national forest is like 1,000 ewes and their lambs, and it's like, hey.
Right.
This is a good deal.
Yeah. Party.
Exactly.
Easy to catch.
And the wolves then, you know, I'm just kind of getting to the point of how we have a pack on the north side of Mount Shasta.
Sure.
Is they did expand across Oregon as a threatened species, you know, and, you know, I think you guys have probably tracked that one wolf that went back and forth between California.
Yep. OR7.
Yeah, and so there's a wolf pack. So, and, you know, it's part of the natural ecosystem, and there's going to be a lot of opinions on and people's thoughts on on the value of a wolf and the wolf as part of the ecosystem and how the but we, again, as a Forest Service, see, we don't manage the wildlife. The states do,
mm-hmm.
or if it's a threatened and endangered species, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service does. We, however, manage multiple uses, and that's our involvement then. And so,
well, because you know, there are all these myths surrounding the idea of wolves. You know, they eat only the sick animals. You know, so they make the herd stronger. Well, that's stupid. They don't eat the sick animals. They eat the good ones. I mean, it's
they
like us.
We eat the slow ones.
Yeah, we don't go to the grocery store and get the rotten produce. So
they definitely take advantage of because they are so smart mm-hmm. and adaptable. They will take this, you know, the easier prey.
Sure.
So
if it was in Yellowstone, the weaker buffalo, they would definitely take that.
Well, they eat the young. I mean, the
young.
They like
calves. You don't replace the herd with the young ones.
Are they veal if they're buffalo?
I don't know.
No, only cows, huh?
Yeah.
They're
it
veal.
Might be. But the, you know, the moose, where I was, the moose seemed to be a little more vulnerable because the moose mm-hmm. and calves would stay up higher in the mountains and in the snow.
But you said they were pretty smart. What did the moose do to?
The wolves were smart.
Yeah, the moose were just
ordinary.
So the moose didn't no. You know, kind of figure out a way around it.
No,
they
fight. Eventually
they didn't do well.
Young all got
from everything
eaten
I read.
And, yeah, so, they hamstring them and.
You know, we will manage the habitat, and mm-hmm. And that's our job. And it is it's interesting though to watch across a very large geographical area that we're talking about from Idaho and Wyoming to this wolf pack now on the north side of Mount Shasta, and definitely plenty of controversy around wolves. And
what do you project, knowing now that the wolves are here? What do you see in the near and distant future as far as the impact of the wolf in our area? What do you expect?
Well, I think they're very adaptable because, and I do need to say there are some fantastic wolf biologists,
mm-hmm.
and that's a good question for them. I don't know except for I know from my experience they do well where there's a predator or a prey base, elk,
sure.
deer. You know, they will get on private land and, you know, because they don't see the national forest boundaries.
No.
And we know that.
Yeah.
You know, they,
the idea that they're going to just stay in, public land.
They might eat a 4-H project. Yeah.
They see a cow or a lamb or a pig. It's like, we don't eat those.
Well, in New
those.
Mexico, they have cages where the kids wait for the buses. So, you know,
the hard
not
thing
opposed
is,
to children either.
Often as we watch the wolves on the forest I've worked on, again, expand is just watching how far some of the collared wolves would travel between Idaho and Wyoming.
Oh, yeah, that's amazing.
Amazing
isn't it?
Stories.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, you know, so they crossed into Northern California, and you'll see them, you know, the young ones satellite out, and it's just amazing how they'll travel. And so it's just a lot of opinions on it.
Right, right.
Well, what about hikers and that kind of thing?
I don't think there's a problem at all with the people, per se. I've never seen a problem with.
They do attack people.
They could. I haven't seen it where we even had high densities of wolf packs because mm-hmm. generally they go away from people. Compared to other species like a grizzly bear, they're like, boy, I don't want to walk into their space.
Right.
I've seen wolves and they'll just want to avoid you.
Right.
Well,
but
the collaring of them kind of makes them people. You know, they say that the more they collar them and handle them, the less afraid of people that they are?
Well, that could be. I think they get them conditioned, though, to the natural environment. They're wild. They are definitely wild wolves.
Mm-hmm.
And
are you allowed? Are you guys allowed to do anything to manage for them near campgrounds or any of that? What do you do if you have a wolf that was being a problem? You have to call Fish and Wildlife?
Yeah, we would call U.S. Fish and Wildlife or the California Fish and Wildlife.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Because you guys don't do that.
No.
Because they're animals. You guys only
right.
do, like, the trees and the ground.
The wildlife.
Yeah. And fortunately, where this pack is, we don't have a lot of permitted livestock on the forest. You know, where some areas you would expect direct effects. If I had a lot of permitted sheep on the forest, well, I'd be concerned that we'd probably be running into predation problems. We don't have mm-hmm. that there.
That's
so
good.
I'm not really concerned about effects on national forests with this wolf pack.
No, I think it's going to be a while before anybody even reports a sighting. I mean, when you're only dealing with a, with such a small group.
Oh, they see them up north. There's more than one wolf pack. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I think it'll be a while before we see any impacts, but I do believe there will be impacts.
Well, and since there are listed species, you're not allowed to do. It's considered unlawful to do anything that would cause them to burn calories. That's the definition of harassment.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess you can, you know, mentally will them to go the other way, away from your animals. But, you know,
but don't run.
Because we were like, okay, can you, like, chase them with an ATV or something? And they, you know, no. And bottom line is it came down to anything that causes them to burn calories you can't do.
Yeah, but you can't do that to deer either.
It's like,
you can't harass wild.
Yeah, but you're not worried about deer coming and snacking on your, you know, livestock.
That's true.
Deer are good. Deer just roam around and get in the way of your car.
I mean, but even elk will predate on agricultural food.
That's true. Elk are kind of a pain.
All wildlife need managed.
Yeah, they do.
I mean,
yeah.
Places.
And, you know, I manage them with a side of potatoes and some gravy, and I'll tell you what.
There you go.
This is our PETA moment, the people eating tasty animals. Bob, what do you have for us?
Quick break.
On that note.
What's that?
You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
I sleep all night and I work all day.
Here's a lumberjack and he's okay. Sleeps all night and he works all day.
I cut down trees, I eat my lunch, I go to the lavatory. On Wednesdays I go shopping and have hot and scones for tea.
He cuts down trees, eats his lunch, he goes to the lavatory. On Wednesdays he goes shopping.
Yeah. Where's the high heels?
Yeah, no.
I like the part about
him
wearing high heels.
I think that was the Monty Python version.
Oh.
That was Monty Python.
I was going to say, wait a minute, that's the only version there is.
Yeah, well, we cut the high heels part out.
One more
we didn't figure Dave would mind.
Just for you. Just for you, Dave.
Thank you.
One more salute to the Marching Lumberjacks.
Exactly.
We changed the lyrics to that one, the Marching
I'll
Lumberjacks.
I'll bet you did.
I think I remember those lyrics. We had
boy.
Lots of fun doing that.
Yeah, so okay. On the break we learned that...
we always learn more on the break.
Yeah.
we should just leave
the mics open
on the
break.
Yeah, we're super sorry you couldn't be with us on the break. Because we always learn all sorts of fun stuff.
Yeah, but you have a mule team.
We do. We have a.
No, what'd you call it? A mule train?
String.
String.
Mule string.
So you know, mules are pack animals, and we have what I call a world class pack string, and I'm really proud of that on this national forest. And it's we have packers working out of our Weaverville office, and. That pack string with our, you know, led by horses and our packers and.
What do they pack?
So they pack in all the food and equipment for our trail crews and maintaining and building new trails in the wilderness area.
The Trinity where there's Elks. No vehicles allowed.
That's right.
Yeah.
And it's the kind of experience that is expected in the wilderness trails.
Sure.
You know, in remote and a lot of solitude. So how do you get it in there? You pack it on mules, and it's just they just do a fantastic job, but. It's becoming more rare to have a really good pack string. Our pack string was so good, and I'll brag about this a little bit.
How good are they?
They were in the Rose Parade this year.
Oh, no fooling.
Yeah, and they were, so they also pack in a lot of firefighting equipment when we have fires back there.
Hmm.
So you don't have to use helicopters. So
how many are there?
Yes.
Well, we have 20-some mules. But in a pack string, you might have 6 to 8.
Mm-hmm.
So
who takes care of them?
We do, the Forest Service.
But like, where do they live?
Well, up at the barn in Weaverville. You know, we feed them hay in the summer, but they're up on the forest, you know, up in the meadows uh-huh. when they go in. In the wintertime, they're actually down here in Redding area.
Mm-hmm.
No kidding.
Yeah.
I bet they like doing it.
Mules love to be worked. They need a job, kind of like our Australian Shepherd dog. He mm-hmm. needs a job, and these mules need to be worked, and they don't want to be left behind when you leave the barn with the horse trailer. They want to be in there ready to go to work.
Yeah.
And well-trained, and you need professionals, and those are packers. They know how to pack an animal properly.
A mule's a big animal.
Yeah, it's crossed, of course, between a horse and a donkey.
A donkey, yeah.
So
they're kind of, you know, I mean, there's all the stubbornness and all that, so
sure.
You have to kind of know what you're doing.
Definitely have to know what you're doing to be safe out there so you don't have we call it a wreck if things go bad.
Mm-hmm.
A wreck.
Yeah, so... And you know, you match them up well, and they're and you train them, so you're not taking green mules out. We went to the Midwest, I think it was maybe Kansas, to buy our mules, and they're matched mules. Looked really good in the Rose Parade. We were there with our chief of the Forest Service this last year, and
Carrying stuff?
Yeah, we had them packed like with the traditional packs of what they might have carried, and then... we had a couple strings, actually 3 strings. One carried firefighting equipment. One carried culverts and things like that we would use for trail construction.
Wow, you have pictures of them? Need mm-hmm. to send me some pictures. I'll put them on the site.
Yeah, so it was, they could carry hundreds of pounds.
Mm-hmm.
And so they'll carry all the food in. We have a trail crew. It's the California Conservation Crew that we work with. Great organization. They have a backcountry crew of young adults, mostly young. Well, they are young.
Are they volunteers or are these
paid
employees?
They get paid a little bit,
uh-huh.
Not a lot. But they go in for 5 months straight into the wilderness.
Wow.
Oh, wow.
They don't come out on weekends. They don't come out even once every 30 days. They're in there.
Sounds like a young man's sport right there.
And, you know, I went in and saw them this summer, and there was women there too. And
yeah.
They're working really hard. Maintaining trails and building trails that will stay in the wilderness, they won't erode out, requires a lot of solid engineering techniques
mm-hmm.
and trail construction and design. And these, so we do that, and these crews build those trails, and it's right down to it's all crowbars, you know, moving big boulders.
Yeah, they're using the rocks and the logs and the stuff that's there
and
to build the trails.
The old star bits, this is primitive handwork. They're pounding rock with sledges to get smaller rocks to fill in the grooves.
Mm-hmm.
You know, designing it so if a horse is going up the trail, it has just the right stride and step so it's not having to hop,
right,
if you will. And so incredible. A lot of people don't know that work goes on in the backcountry.
Sure.
But it's a big job maintaining our trail system.
How much trails? I think you said there was
it's just
so many miles of trails in the forest.
I just looked that up a little bit ago.
Yeah, it was like 1,400 miles or something of trails.
It was 1,538 miles.
Yeah, so just...
That's a lot.
And in wilderness, again, it's non-mechanized, so it's not like you're using rock drills
mm-hmm.
that are mechanized.
No, it's all hand stuff.
It's hand, where somebody's holding that star bit and others hitting it with a sledgehammer to drill a hole, to bust them apart and all that.
Wow.
Now, did you have mules at your other, up in Montana, and is this common? Like, do all the forests have them?
No, they don't. We did on the Shoshone National Forest, which is right adjacent to Yellowstone. Where you have a lot of wilderness and backcountry, you pretty much need pack strings to get your people in to do work. It's surprising, too, how much public use there is in the wilderness areas. Sometimes you'll hear, oh, it's an area of no use because there's no mechanized use. Well, that's a fallacy.
Right.
There's a lot of use. And, you know, people that want a recreation experience where they want a little bit more solitude, they want to ride their horse in. And we have great partners, backcountry horsemen. And in this area in Redding, there's a fantastic backcountry horseman.
What do the horses and mules eat? Do they eat the vegetation that's there, or do you have to haul food in for them?
Well, we'll haul in, if they're going to stay, some grain or pelleted food.
Mm-hmm.
But they'll just be out in the dry meadows or wet meadows to forage, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
They stay around. And just so you probably have to stake out the bell mare, because you don't want the mules to get a wild hare and head back to the barn, exactly, which is 20 miles away,
mm-hmm,
you know.
Somebody's going to be doing a lot of walking.
Yeah. And off they go.
Stranger things have happened, you know.
Right.
So,
interesting. So if you have some sort of a medical issue, they can probably bring a person out, too.
Oh, yeah. Maybe. Yeah. And, you know, if we do get true medical issues in the wilderness, we do allow, search and rescue, or the sheriff can fly a helicopter in.
A helicopter.
Yeah, we still do.
You have radios
like
and
that.
Communication.
Sure, everybody has a cell phone back there.
Sure.
Mount Shasta is a wilderness area, so that has an incredible.
The actual Mount Shasta?
Mm-hmm. Incredible mountaineering program we have there. And people are always climbing up Mount Shasta, you know, just to climb and to, then they slide down. And
yeah,
they're always getting hurt. And
yeah,
you're
yeah,
always
every
hearing
year
about some
every year
situation.
We partner with Siskiyou County and CHP to rescue people. But a fantastic mountaineering program. We have an avalanche program to, you know, predict or warn for avalanches. Because this is, again, a whole – it's amazing how many people are going up Mount Shasta every day.
Yeah,
just hiking, and a lot of different types of people and users up there as well.
Yeah,
and the
varying skills, international abilities,
international visitors.
Oh yeah, that's
too.
not a rookie trip to go up top of Mount Shasta.
Well, it's 14,000 feet.
14,000
right?
feet.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that's you don't want to play around with something like that. You could end up.
I hiked up.
Not doing it again.
Living. Yeah.
I hiked part way up, then took a picture of that second half that I didn't hike up. I was like, you definitely noticed the oxygen difference.
Oh, man, I noticed that we went up Lassen, and that's only, 10-something, and you're huffing and puffing up there.
Yeah.
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 That's pretty cool.
Okay.
Well, thanks a million zillion.
Great. Thanks for
right.
coming in.
Thank you.
Coming
yeah,
in and hanging out with
you.
Us.
Great to have us.
So, okay, we want to put some contact info on there. We have it all on the website, and so people can get a hold of you if they have questions. And if they want to go be a forest person, ranger, and that kind of stuff, fun job.
It's a great job.
There you go.
Good.
Go use your national forest. But don't grow pot in it, please.
Yeah.
Hey, this has been We the People Radio. You can find everything about us online, wethepeopleradio.us, and we'll see you next week.